because you're jumping back into the gap. I'll let the coach, it's either sideline, two on the side, three on the side. That's off the second cut. Leads the country in offensive rebounding.
Hey, coach. Welcome to the Basketball Podcast. I'm your host, Chris Oliver, the founder, CEO, and creative mind behind BasketballImmersion.com. This is the podcast where you will hear real basketball coaching conversations. Whether you are a new or experienced coach at any level of basketball, these coaching conversations will give you practical ideas to stimulate your coaching and make what you do even better. Without any more delay, let's share the game. Welcome to the Basketball Podcast. Today, I'm very grateful to have a coach who's been in basketball for 40 years, Dave Severns, currently with the Los Angeles Clippers as pro personnel scout, but has served many roles in his time in basketball, including director of player development, assistant coach, and going back a long time ago, a name that many people would be familiar with is he's worked with Tim Grover and the Nike Basketball Academies as well. But coach, if we were to talk about your bio and your experiences, I don't even know where we'd start. What an incredible basketball career that continues into your 40th year. Congratulations.
Well, I guess that just means I'm old. And I started right out of college, you know, as like a 21-year-old. So,
well, old but successful.
Well,
you know,
sometimes.
And coach, we've had a chance to meet, but more importantly, long before I ever met you, I've followed a lot of your stuff. In particular, as I mentioned to you, the Pistols video and the Hurry Up Offense video and different things that you've shared as a coach, and just, again, tremendous resource. And I thought it's one of the best DVDs that I've seen, and the clinic that you did at Northern Arizona, which is on YouTube as well, on the Pistols offense. Just really awesome and useful and practical stuff. So thanks for sharing. And
thank you.
Pistols is still relevant nowadays, isn't it?
Yeah, a lot of teams will run variations of it. But yeah, more and more teams are going to it, especially in the NBA. And now I've seen it trickle down to, you know, college teams are running more of it now also. And I get a lot of inquisitions from high school coaches now that they're trying to do it.
Well, and of course, and the one value of it, not that this is going to turn into a Pistols conversation completely, but one value is that, especially for a high school coach, you basically don't have five players that can all play. So Pistols allows you to put your best players right in situations that can create advantage right away, and have other players learn how to play off that situation or off the advantage. And I've always loved that, because I've even found at my level, I frequently would have two really good guards, but not necessarily mm-hmm. the third. And the third guy is usually, you know, he can shoot it, so he can play off of it. But it's a great situation to be able to get right to an action. And anything yeah. else from that you've seen an advantage in terms of running Pistols?
Oh, well, I just think it can get you high quality shots, not just 3-point shots, but opportunities for drives and cuts as well. And as a bonus, if you do have a post player that's pretty good on the block, you know, it allows you to roll him and get him into the block and still maintain really good spacing.
Well, and that's the trend in the game, that you don't start your post in the block. You get him right to the block through cuts or rolls. And you're absolutely right. That Pistols gives a tremendous opportunity for that. Coach, I think moving into, you know, one of the topics that I thought was outstanding that you suggested we talk about a little bit, which I know we've made lots of mistakes in our time. You only because you've made more only because you've coached longer than I have, but talk a little bit about some of the mistakes that we've made in coaching. You in particular can share with us that
sure.
coaches could learn from, and particularly focusing on high school coaches and some of the mistakes that you see that we can correct or we can help stimulate their thinking.
Yeah, and I hope that, you know, that high school coaches that listen to this don't take this in a negative way. But I coached in high school for 15 years, and it was probably still my most favorite time and my most favorite level was the high school level, because of the relationships that you develop with your players that last. You know, here I am 40 years into it, and I still have relationships with players that I coached, you know, 38, 39 years ago as a young high school coach. But I made a lot of mistakes. And if I could ever go back and coach high school again, and maybe it's a possibility someday. So as a high school coach, please take this as maybe advice. And these are what I call the top 10 mistakes that high school coaches, and I've made them all. And just try to help high school coaches maybe understand, you know, how they can run a better program and be a better coach by understanding some of the mistakes that I think we make.
Great. Well, it sounds awesome. And it'll stimulate thinking and Coach, what's the first one?
Okay, number one is take a bad job. And what I mean by that is take a bad job. There's no budget. There's no tradition. There's no players. There's bad or unrealistic expectations from the administration. There's no qualified help. Those things. And I understand that sometimes I know that young coaches just have to take a job because they need a job. But if you have an opportunity or a choice between jobs, I think those are things you need to look at. The budget, the tradition, the players, and probably the most important thing in there, Chris, is unrealistic expectations from administrators, you know, principals, athletic directors, boosters. And a lot of times, you know, I've seen guys take jobs where there were, you know, several of those problems that I just mentioned. So I think sometimes taking a bad job can be a mistake. And don't misunderstand me. I know, like, the first high school job as a head coach I ever took, I needed a job, you know, with benefits and a teaching position. And it was a bad job. And we didn't win a game my first year because of some of those reasons. So I think that's one of the biggest mistakes high school coaches can make is taking a bad job.
Right. And as you says, it's a...
Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, no. But, you know, the challenge is when you take jobs or when you interview for jobs, I mean, you've got to really go in depth to find out the problems before you take the job.
Yeah, absolutely.
Definitely as a young coach, I mean, you know, the depth of what you're saying is to don't just take the people that are interviewing you or the people that are one step removed from the program, like dig a little deeper to find out what's actually there. Because, I mean, in the jobs that I've had, there's definitely been stuff that I wish I knew about right away. And I didn't think of enough.
Yeah. And one of the further mistake, I think, when we just take any job that's offered to us is we don't ask the right question in the interview. I think coaches need to do a better job of asking people running the interview question.
Well, Coach,
about their expectations.
Let's give
like
a few examples. Let's give a few examples.
Yeah.
Because I'm telling you, that's one of those things I tell coaches all the time, too. And not that I've interviewed as much as a lot of coaches, but when you interview, you get an opportunity to ask questions. And I don't think coaches know what to ask. So let's give some examples, Coach. What should you ask?
I think the number one thing is you ask the administrations, what are your expectations? I'll never forget, I interviewed for a high school job one time. It was a really good job. And the principal said to me, our expectations are to win a state championship in Division I. And this is in California, where it's really competitive. And that kind of took me aback a little bit. So I think we need to ask the administrators in charge, the ADs, the principal, superintendent, whoever it is, what are your expectations for the program? And put them on the spot a little bit, because sometimes they may not even know. So I think that's one of the first things that you have to be aware of is what are the expectations of the administrator?
Well, and I couldn't agree more. And the other one that I would add to that is what is expected to be coach-led versus administratively led?
Yeah, that's a great way to put it.
Well, you know what? I'm in those situations all the time where it's like, I sometimes feel like everything is coach-led. And I'm like, well, what are the expectations for me? Fine. Okay, you want me to do everything. Well, what are the expectations in terms of you and the support that you're going to provide me that isn't just 100% coach-led? And that's tricky, but I think the great administrations will have an answer for that, and you'll be able to tell right away that they're there to support you.
Yeah, and you get the answer back from them, something along the lines of, well, we just want you to win. I think you're going down a long and difficult road if that's the answer that you get back from the administration.
Well, because it's not. You're absolutely right, because then it's – well, and again, we all know sports somewhat is evaluated based on wins and losses, no matter what anyone says. But there's reasons to coach, and there's reasons to run a program, and there's reasons to support a program beyond winning, and you'll hope that whatever job you get, that there's value to things.
Yeah, especially at the high school level where, you know, a lot of times, more often than not, you just kind of coach whoever walks through the door. You know, we're talking about public high schools now. So,
of course.
Anyway, number two, a failure to improve at their craft. I see a lot of cases, and I was guilty of this, spending too much time working at, besides coaching, you know, all the ancillary things, boosters, media, speaking, trying to promote yourself at the expense of exchanging ideas, reading, you know, clinics, watching videos, collaboration with other coaches. Yeah, I think you kind of envision, you know, the young coach that gets a job and he's really fired up about having the booster club and getting involved with the media and going out and speaking and trying to promote their program, which is all good, but at the expense of, you know, becoming a better coach, you know, watching video, reading, exchanging ideas with other coaches, clinics. I think sometimes we can get caught up in spending too much time at those things instead of really focusing in on our craft.
Well, in certain jobs where you have more support, you have more time to do that. In other jobs, clearly you have to do other things. And a lot of high school coaches obviously have other jobs as well. So there's challenges in that.
But right.
Hey, there's no better path to improvement. And I think it's proven throughout the NBA now in terms of your development as a coach than the video room, right? Like, it just seems like there's a massive trend over, I don't know how long it's been, but that guys from the video room are progressing through NBA coaching ranks because.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Yeah, this is my 11th year now involved with the NBA. And when I first started, it was like one guy in the video room, or maybe two. And all of a sudden now, I just left our video room this morning. You know, we have five guys in there. It's a really, really big trend that we've seen, you know, in the NBA is the development and the advancement in technology and video.
Well, and that's something that, again, is within your control as a coach, too, because, you know, there's no limit, so to speak, on your mind in terms of your improvement. You know, coach, I want to add one more thing.
And your imagination, for sure.
That's great. I think it's Stephen Covey that said that one of the habits of highly effective people is proficient note-taking. And I can't believe how many clinics I attend and how many practices I attend or whatnot. And I see coaches not taking notes or just literally just sitting there. Maybe it's me and it's my approach, but, and we all have different approaches, but I just can't believe you can take in information at clinics and camps and, you know, everything. I have a notebook all the time and I still do it. And
yeah, I'm with you. And I'm old school and, you know, I probably went to my first coaching clinic 40 years ago and somewhere I probably have those notes. I'll never forget it. It's in San Jose, California, and Bobby Knight's the main guy, and we're at a high school. And I just one of those guys that, you know, would write down almost everything. Now, today, you know, almost everything's videoed and you can get it on the internet or YouTube or something. So maybe, you know, coaches kind of just figuring I don't need to write stuff down because I can go back and watch it later. But I think writing anything down gives you a chance to go back and learn it two or three times over and over. I think that's a great way to learn. So I'm with you on that note-taking thing. I'm always writing stuff down.
Well, and I've studied this a little bit because I taught at the university level for a while, and there's nothing probably more detrimental to learning than just me 60 minutes lecturing to university students.
You know, yeah. So hey, try 60 minutes film session with the NBA guys. They're going to be asleep after 15.
So coach, there's this thing called a pause recall method, which is basically that you talk for 6 to 8 minutes, and every 6 to 8 minutes, you pause for 2 minutes. And in those 2 minutes, so they're not allowed to take notes for the 6 minutes, but in those 2 minutes, they're supposed to take notes. And the idea in that you're paying attention and then you write down what's relevant
right.
to you. And that's something that I found to be very effective in terms of helping me take better notes and be more conscious of what I'm writing down and writing down stuff that's valuable because it's going to stick with me.
Yeah. And I remember, Chris, I spent many years as a classroom teacher at the high school level, and if you don't change up the lesson plan and move to something else every 5 to 7 to 10 minutes, you're going to lose them. You got to be able to change it up and go to something different within your lesson plan every few minutes, or you're going to lose a large majority of your class.
Yeah, no question. No question, coach. Well, these are good things. So,
number three. I think we're on three, right?
Yeah, we're on three.
Okay. And this is something that I see so much of at the high school level. Too much complaining at the officials. First of all, it's something you can't control, but most importantly, it also gives your players an out for their mistakes. I mean, if you're constantly complaining to the referees as a high school coach, your players are going to look at that as an out for mistakes that they're making on the court. I just see so much of it, and I was guilty of it myself. If I ever coached high school again, I know that's one thing. Now, look, you got to understand, if you're a high school coach, you're not going to get the best referees. You know, if you're a college coach, you probably think you're not getting the best referees either. We get the best referees in the NBA, and guys are still complaining to them.
Well, Coach, so you notice I'm staying.
Cycle. Yeah.
I'm staying silent. I'm staying silent. So.
Yeah, you're not going to win that one.
No.
So I really, some advice I would give to a young high school coach, lay off the ref. For sure, you know, there's going to be times where you're going to need to try to make your point with them. But that's something that I really feel strongly about, is complaining at the officials.
Coach, I've certainly made these mistakes, like this one especially. Like, it's just, I'm such a better coach when you remove competition. And competition changes, you know, I think it changes everyone, but, you know, this one factor where somebody, and it's been studied that basketball officials have more control over the game than just about any other sport.
Yeah, it's because it's so subjective.
It is so subjective. It is so subjective. And it's one of those challenges, but I think the mindset is definitely, what type of impact are you making on your players? And you said that. I mean, we're role models, and we're also trying to model behavior that hopefully your players don't get involved in all the things other than playing the game as well as they can.
Yeah, I totally agree. And the other thing is the parents in the stands. Now they kind of see that, oh, the coach can yell at and complain at the officials. It gives me license to do the same. If they see the coach acting like an idiot toward the refs, I tell you what, it's not long before those parents start getting into it also. And now you've just opened up a crazy can of worms.
Yes, of course, of course. Coach, we're on to number four.
Number four, not spending enough practice time on special situations. Some games in high school are blowouts either way, a lot of games. But for the close ones, I think the team needs to, you know, they need to have prepared for what may occur so they are not facing it the first time. I see so many times, and I'm guilty of this when I coached high school, where you're in a close game and panic mode sets in a little bit. You know, it's like we're down two with 5 seconds to go and it's our ball underneath the basket and you panic, you know. If you've been there and you've done those and prepared for those in practice, and it just takes time and it takes experience. You know, you're not going to, you know, as a first or second year varsity high school coach, you may have not been in those situations ever before in your life. So I think you need to prepare for that. We don't spend enough time on those special situations. And then panic sets in and then the players panic and then, you know, it's crazy. So we need to spend more time on that.
Coach, can you give us some insights in terms of how the NBA approaches special situations? And I say that, Coach, because what we often see is the play that works, right?
Yeah.
That's the one that shows up on social media, et cetera, but how do they get to that point? Have they worked on that play? Is it diagramming?
No, for the most part, those are almost always prepared. But I think the NFL and football coaches do a great job because they break the game down into the three areas that I think basketball should also. They break it down into offense, defense, and special teams. That's it. And, you know, we do a pretty good job with our offense and our defense, but we don't do a good enough job with special teams. And I think we could really benefit ourselves as basketball coaches by studying how football coaches approach it. And third of their practice time is special situation, special team. So I think we do a disservice by not spending enough time. In the NBA, there's a lot of time that's spent on those. I know with the coaches that I've been with, you know, it's at least the last 20 to 30 minutes of practice are spent on special situations. You know, you need two, need threes, how to foul. And so when the games come, you know, the players have seen those plays. And coaches put them in situations to be able to execute those. You know, some of the best guys that you see are Doc, Brad Stevens, Stan Van Gundy. Those guys do great jobs of preparing their teams for those special situations, those in-the-game plays, you know, offense and defense. So, but the NBA does a really good job, I think, of preparing their teams because there's so many of those situations that come up in the course of the game.
So
we do a really good job of preparing our guys for that.
Let me ask you then, so within that 20 to 30 minutes of practice, are they 5-on-0 going through a play? Are they 5-on-5 going through a play?
Both.
Within the NBA.
A lot of it is like football. Okay.
Yep.
These are the five guys that are in the game at the end. Come over here and huddle up with coach. Okay, and then you got five defensive players waiting. They don't know what's coming. So a lot of it is 5-on-5 where the defense doesn't know, you know, and then you just put them in the situation. And it's timing. It's, first of all, it's knowing where to start. See, football, what do they do every time they line up for a play? they get into a formation and they've just had a chance to huddle up or look over on the sideline now because there's really no more huddles. So they look over at the sideline, they get the formation from the coach or the card or whatever. And so that's where it starts. First of all, you got to be in the right spot. And there's no excuse for not being in the right spot. You just had a timeout and the coach showed you where to go. So that's the first thing. The second thing is the timing. And then the third thing are the options. If they take away, you know, the first option, what's our counter to that? And those really can't be taught unless it's 5-on-5.
Yeah, no, that's great. And I think that's really important for coaches to understand because really in the NBA, you have less practice time. You have more games, but you have less practice time.
Almost no practice time, Chris. It would shock you how much they are not able to practice. I mean, 5-on-5 scrimmaging, you know.
Right. Right.
During the course of the year, you could probably count on, you know, one hand, the number of times you really get after it once the season starts in a 5-on-5 practice situation. Now, some coaches do more than others.
Of course.
But it's amazing how much, but you can still do special situations, and most teams do.
Right. And do they do that often in the game day shoot around as well, where a portion of game
absolutely.
Day shoot around?
Every time. Okay. Yeah. Every game day shoot around, there's going to be two or three end of game plays. And now you need to understand also that the coach may see something on the fly in the course of a game that they haven't practiced yet.
Of course.
And that's where really paying attention in the huddle comes into play. Because if all five guys aren't really paying attention and know where to start, number one, and the timing and the spacing, number two, then the play is going to get screwed up. So Brad Stevens, you watch him and sometimes he just draws something up because he saw it. Doc's the same way. He saw something that he thinks is going to work that we haven't covered, but he draws it up. So you got to be able to pay attention.
I think coaches would be curious to know that it's most of it, what we see on TV is prepared, but there's definitely improvised moments.
Oh, absolutely.
And that's definitely the same, I think, at most levels. But the point is to reduce the number of improvised moments as much as possible that your players have seen.
Yes.
As you said, they've seen the formation or you've practiced out of the formation. You may improvise a counter in that formation, but they've at least got a base from which to start from so that it's not all completely new learning.
And I think absolutely. And it helps bring the stress level of the players down, makes them feel a little more confident and comfortable because, you know, hey, we've been practicing this play all week, man. Yeah, we may or may not make the shot, but we can get a shot. So.
Well, that's great.
What was that, four? Was that four, Chris?
That's four. We're on five.
Okay. Okay, number five, excessive talking at practice. You'd be amazed how much you go to a practice and how much the coach talks. To my thing, it's like, okay, you already have the job. There's really no need to show people how smart you are. Okay, and more repetitions, better efficient use of practice time, less talking. A lot of times coaches really like to hear themselves talk. I tell you what was really interesting is listening to your podcast with my guy, Guy Malloy from New Zealand, Australia. And you guys talked about, you know, miking up a coach and then the coach listening to him afterwards and being amazed at what he was saying and how and what he wasn't saying and the language that he was using. I thought that was great. Excessive talking in practice, I think, can be a big thing. You got to be careful.
Yes, no, and coach, I mean, this is up my wheelhouse because for me as a coach, I mean, one of the biggest things that I'm obsessed with is time on task, where I know from the literature and everything that's said is that our players learn by doing. That means by physically practicing. They don't learn by me talking. And the other part of that I always, how I frame this to coaches is that this is not a coaching clinic. How you would approach a coaching clinic is completely different than how you would coach your players. And I think that's awesome advice, coach. So, and that's great. Number six,
not spending enough time off the court with your players. The guys need to buy in. They need to see and they need to get to know you away from basketball. And there's three coaches that I kind of studied, one that I actually got to work for that I thought really excelled at this. And one was Coach Tarkanian, who I worked for and got to see up close and personal. And two others that I've studied and watched, Coach Raveling, Coach George Raveling. And then there was an old-time coach way back. I think his last job might have been at the University of Oregon as a head coach. His name was Dick Harger. And those guys, I learned that you know, you need to get to know your guys off the court as much as you can, especially in high school. And I think in high school, it's great. It's fun. I mean, to get to know the guys. And so I think that's something that, you know, a lot of times the coaches who just walk out the gym and get in their car and leave after practice, don't have the kids over to the house or whatever. I think that's something that really hurts coaches, and it can really help you if you spend time, quality time, get to know the guys off the court. I think that's really important, especially, you know, with high school players.
Well, and it doesn't have to be all these team cohesion events and, you know, everything.
No.
It can be informal moments and just informal conversations. And it doesn't always have to happen in your office, which is the other thing that I see mistakes made, is that
it probably shouldn't happen in your office.
A player is completely different in my office than he is anywhere else.
Hey, what do they think the office is? You know what they think the office is? The principal's office. Come on. I mean, now, if you have an open door policy, but your door is never open, what's that say? You know, and coaches say all the time, I got an open door policy, come by anytime you want, you know, in between classes or whatever. And then they go by and your door's always shut. That's something I never understood.
No, I agree on that one. So no, that's so true. I mean, the value of that relationship goes beyond coaching as well. I mean, we're coaching people, and that's so impactful.
Number seven, Chris, more devotion to fundamentals. Passing, shooting, footwork, understanding the difference between a good shot and a bad shot, not just dribbling, but dribbling with the purpose, passing with the purpose, all those things that fall under the umbrella of fundamentals. I think more devotion to fundamentals is something that I think should be done, especially with, you know, high school coaches.
And Coach, how much of the fundamentals changed?
Yeah, let me be honest with you, man. The only thing that I've seen that's really changed is a three-point shot. And obviously, when I played and when I coached for a long time, they didn't have it. So the emphasis on the three-point shot has changed. But other than that, the fundamentals really haven't. I mean, the actual jump shot came in and when, the 40s or the 50s? And can you think of anything besides the actual jump shot that is new since then? I can't. I mean, no. You still got to pass. You still got to rebound. You still got to move your feet defensively, you know, all that stuff. So I don't think the fundamentals have changed. I try to really emphasize when I talk to coaches or clinics or talk to young kids, look, the fundamentals haven't changed. The fundamentals of our guys haven't changed. They're just bigger, stronger, faster. But you still got to be able to pass, shoot, have good footwork, and all those basic fundamental things. I really think that's important.
So analytics have changed the expression of the fundamental, but they haven't changed the fundamental.
Yes. Yeah, that's a good way to put it. I mean, analytics have totally changed kind of the way you want to play and what kind of a shot you want to get and all that. But the fundamentals of getting that shot haven't changed.
The one question I'll pose to you, Coach, is there a perfect technique? Is there a perfect technique? Because that seems very old school to me, where a coach is very rigid in his, this is the one way to pass or this is the one way to shoot. Whereas...
No, I don't think there's... Because every player, every biomechanics of everybody are different.
Right.
I don't think you could say there's one perfect technique. Now, there's probably a perfect technique for every player, if that makes sense.
No, that's well said. Yeah.
Yeah. But there's not going to be, you know, one technique for every player, for everybody. I mean, you can just think in your mind, and right now in my mind, I'm getting all these visions of, you know, different guys who shoot the ball differently.
Of course.
But very effective, a lot of them that I'm thinking of. So I don't think there's a perfect technique, but there is a perfect technique for every player. And you got to find out what that is.
Well, and I love that. I love how you said that, because I agree. There's no perfect technique. But, Coach, the other thing that I see more of in the game, and again, I believe this is fundamental, is one-hand passing. Whereas, again, a lot of old school, what we would envision as Hoosiers or whatever, you know, Gene Hackman making sure everyone's passing with two hands and all this other stuff. But if I watch the NBA now, the best players in the world, or the WNBA, the best female players in the world, I see so much one-hand passing where the other hand doesn't touch the ball.
Yeah.
And
that's a fundamental that has to be taught, I think. And why? Because it's faster. If you can pass the ball off the dribble with one hand without having to add your second hand, I think that's a fundamental that's much better than passing with two hands. You have to be able to do that.
Yeah. And a part of that is encouragement as well from the coach.
Yeah. And another kind of along the same lines as that, Chris, is the old school. Like I remember back in, you know, middle school and everything, the coach would say, you can't leave your feet to make a pass. Well, that's not true. You know, you can't leave your feet to find a pass.
Right.
You know, you should, you know, once you've found a pass, it's perfectly a good fundamental to be able to leave your feet to make that pass if you found it. Now, you can't leave your feet and then start looking for the pass. That's bad fundamentals. So, I don't know what made me think of that. But.
No, that's great. I mean, it's the correct way of saying it, because I get in those conversations frequently and I try to explain, and I don't have the analytics behind it, but I'm sure, you know, you could get one of someone on Second Spectrum and find that. But what percentage of chest passes actually happen in the game anymore?
Yeah, and when should it happen? To me, the only time the chest pass is now part of the game, and it is still part of it, is an advanced pass up the court.
Right, right.
And you get the outlet and you look up court and you advance it. You're not going to throw a chest pass in a pick and roll game. We don't teach any of the passes in the pick and roll game with chest pass. Now, what about a behind the back pass? I think that's important for a guard to be able to, you know, when they ice the pick and roll and you take it down to the wing, you to be able to throw the behind the back pass to the guy who's popped. It's more efficient. So 30 years ago, we may not have taught that. But now I think that's a fundamental you do need to teach.
And I may be wrong on this, but I've always hypothesized that defense has actually gone through the biggest evolution in the game. And the complexity of rotations and defense and different, even a closeout. Like I think if I did a basketball camp 15 years ago, 10 years ago with young people, and I said, how many people know what a closeout is? I think the numbers of hands up would not be that many. But nowadays, if I do it, like 8-year-olds know what a closeout is. And I think the complexity that we teach defense is much, much deeper.
Yeah, and I think it's a necessity that has come about because of the offensive changes with the three-point line. I tell you, that line has changed everything. It really has. I like it. And by the way, the shot clock, please, please, every state, come on, let's get the shot clock. I saw a couple more states finally went to it this year. But if we can ever get to all 50 states with the shot clock, I think that'd be great. I'm talking about for high school.
Oh, coach, you're the only country in the world that doesn't.
Like, that's crazy. I mean, can't we get every state to? And don't tell me that it's a financial thing. We can't afford the shot clock. Come on. I've been to very, very poor public high schools, and they got shot clocks.
Coach, forget about that. You've been to very, very poor countries that have shot clocks.
Yeah, that's true, too.
You've traveled the world, and there's countries that don't have the resources that we have in the U.S. Yeah. And they have shot clocks. So definitely.
Hopefully that's coming. But that's another argument for another day.
Well, it's not an argument.
Number eight. Okay. Number eight, not worrying about who's the boss. It's about the players. It's not about you as the coach. Right? Being able to avoid controversy, talking down to your players, having too many rules. They know who's in charge. Okay? You don't need to go over the top to try to prove you're the boss. They know. And it's really about your players. So, you know, being able to avoid controversies and talking down to your guys and the rules, which are crazy. And, you know, I've seen some high schools that have a whole, you know, list of rules and stuff. And I've done it. And I think it's better to have standards than it is to have rules. But I think not worrying about who's the boss is really important.
No question. And coach, give us an idea at the NBA level, like, are there rules or are they mainly expectations or they're just a professional?
Well, you know, really, I'll be honest with you, just kind of like be on time.
Yeah.
That's it. Be on time, be ready to go. Now, we have the luxury of finding guys if they're not. But I've been with two head coaches in my time in the NBA. I was very fortunate to work with two guys and neither one of them had a lot of rules. I mean, just be on time. That's it. Be on time, be ready to go. That's really, if you probably asked all 30 NBA head coaches, what's your number one rule? If you had to have one rule, what is it? That's what it would be for almost everybody. Just be on time.
I would agree. I mean, that's the one thing. is a non-negotiable within our program too. It's because it just sends such a message of disrespect or not caring if you're not on time. And certainly there's always life circumstances and different things that come up, but by and large.
I tell you, it's funny. I can think of maybe one time where one of our players showed up late for a shoot around and it was a legitimate traffic thing, you know, here in LA. But even in living here in LA, I mean, our guys are on time. So you high school guys that are coming late and you college players that are coming late, come on, man. If our guys can get here on time, you know, dealing with traffic and all that and families and everything, then you young guys as high school players can be on time.
It's kind of a myth, I find, in talking to people about the NBA, that their impression of kind of NBA players is that they do whatever they want and, you know, they don't care. But everywhere I've gone to watch NBA practices or NBA workouts and stuff, I've been so impressed with the professionalism of the players.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah, and you'd be amazed. I mean, the guys are on time. The amount of preparation that they put into their bodies and into their craft, extra time on their own as they put into their games. Just like you said, the professionalism, the respect given to the coaches and to the support staff is tremendous. I mean, there's not a whole lot of knuckleheads in the NBA, if you know what I mean. If they are, they're not there for long.
Right. And they're open to being coached. Is that fair?
Anything you can do that can help them and then possibly as a byproduct help them get more money, and get another contract or get more playing time, which leads to more money. I mean, anything you can do to help them, they're all ears. And now you got to know your stuff because you can't BS them. But anything that you can do to help those guys, they're all ears. They're in.
That's great. Well, it's great to know. And again, I think there's that sometimes that false impression of that. So it's good. Coach, we're on to number nine.
Yeah. Okay, number nine. Thinking that their philosophy is more important than their personnel. Okay, let me give you an example. New young head coach, he throws off his two best players, two big guys, okay, when he gets the job. One was like a returning, really good player, and the other was like one of the best shot blockers in the conference. They couldn't press the way that he wanted them to press because their big guys didn't move that well. His offense wasn't designed to throw him the ball to the low post. So instead of adjusting, he gets rid of him. So don't be so stubborn, you know, to stick with your philosophy when it's probably more important to adjust to the personnel.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, I've adjusted within a season, let alone, you know, going into a season. And I often say that I really don't truly know the system that's going to work for us until we're a few weeks in because, you know, new dynamics, new team. Like we graduated an outstanding player from last year. So now I've got a bunch of guys that essentially were role players. Now I don't know how they'll be in this next role until we actually start practicing. And I found this year, I mean, we pivoted pretty quickly to realize we couldn't do what we did last year, even though they're familiar with the system, because we didn't have that one player that made everything else easier for everyone else. So
yeah, and especially in high school where, you know, for the most part, you just kind of take whoever shows up. Now I'm not naive enough to think that recruiting doesn't go on because I've been in situations where my kids were recruited from my high school to other places. And then, you know, you have the whole private school that you have to deal with. So I'm not so naive to think that it doesn't happen. But for the most part, you get whoever comes through, right? And you got to be able to adjust and to your personnel. So that's just kind of my two cents on that.
No, I agree with you. So coach number 10.
Okay, falling in love with drills. Every drill should have a purpose directly related to something that's part of what the team's trying to accomplish offense defense. So some coaches just fall in love with certain drills and you watch these drills and then you watch them play and there's no transfer. If you spend, you know, 15 minutes a day denying the wing with a defensive drill, we're going to deny that one pass hard, you know, from point to wing, and then the game starts and they just let them catch the ball. I mean, that's just an example. But, you know, so falling in love with drills just because you like the way the drill looked or you saw it at a clinic and, you know, a college coach was running it that's really successful, it's got to fit. It's got to have a purpose directly related to something that you're trying to do. And I think for the most part, coaches understand that. I've fallen in love with drills where when I you know, step back and really evaluate what we're doing, it's like, you know what, this drill doesn't really fit with what we're trying to do in the games. So I think that's something to really be aware of.
Well, and I'm on board. That's pretty much everything I talk about is this concept of what's the point of the drill and does it transfer and does it help you in the game and all that. And I have a new assistant this year, coach. So it was great because at some point a week ago, he said to me, wow, we were so much better at the beginning of practice. And I said, that's because we're now playing the game. And at the beginning of practice, we were doing a drill. And the drill made us all feel good and made us feel like we're doing something well. We really just did the drill for emphasis of a certain thing that we're going to emphasize within the 5-on-5. But yeah, the drill looked way better than the game. So it made me feel good. So I get sometimes how it's like, okay, the drill, hey, we look like we're getting better, but it doesn't happen. Right. It doesn't happen in the game.
Yeah. Well, I never thought of it. That's good. If the drill a lot of times makes the coach feel good, then the coach keeps doing it.
Of course.
It ain't about you, man. It's about the players and what they're doing. So.
And I always come back to what do players actually enjoy about practice? They like to play basketball. So
they want to hoop.
Yeah, you put them in 4-on-4, 3-on-3, 5-on-5 situations. Man, that's what they want to do. They want to play. And they can play with
their coaching play.
And structure. Yeah.
Yep, and they want to compete and they want to play.
And I'm on board with that, coach. I mean, that's a big one for me. And the whole summary of that is what I call a games approach to coaching, is that you coach them within the game. So that's awesome.
Yeah.
Coach, I love the list. And I'll create a summary of this when we post this for coaches too, that they'll get to see it, and some tremendous information for everyone. And coach, there's so many topics that we wanted to touch on. I don't think we're going to get a chance to get into all of them for this podcast, but we'll get you back on again. But just real quickly, let's touch on switching. Because I think that's something that when we release this podcast, I think we're going to be within this whole era of so many teams at all levels switching a lot. So what are some of the things that you think can help combat switching on offense?
First of all, if we could just kind of back up and understand and try to figure out, you know, why the teams at our level are starting to do it more and more. And it really goes back to the three-point shooting. What can we do defensively to try to keep ourselves out of rotation and not give up so many open three-point shots or open, you know, rolls to the rim? That's basically what it comes down to. And so, you know, we saw the two teams that were in the Western Conference Finals last year switched more than anybody in the league. And you know how success is, you know, more teams are going to start copying that. And rightly so, in my opinion. So we're going to see more and more switching, I think, now because of the emphasis on the hard roll to the rim, the spacing, and the three-point shooting that the league seems to be going to. Therefore, more switching, less rotations. That's just kind of the way we're going. So that's the kind of the why and how we got to this. So I think you offensively, you need to decide, you know, how you're going to attack switches. Some teams will attack it by saying, okay, this is the mismatch we want. We want to put our four in the pick and roll because then we know that they're going to switch our point guard onto it. And now we've got our four isolated. So some teams will attack switches with isolating. Want your best player at the nail against the guard, or you want your best player at the low post, you know, against the guard, whatever. So I think isolation ball is one of the ways that people are attacking it.
Right.
I'm not saying that's the best way. I'm just saying that's what you're seeing a lot of.
Well, you got to have the personnel to make that work, right?
Yeah. And, you know, if it's a 1-3 pick and roll and then, you know, they're going to switch it and our three is our best offensive player. And now you've got your best offensive player going against their point guard, which usually is a length mismatch and you're able to create a shot. If it's a post player, if they're switching their guard onto a post player, we roll them down to the post and they don't double switch it. In other words, they keep the guard on the post down there and try to maybe front it. We're going to try to go to that matchup. So that's one of the ways that the teams are doing it. The second way, and how a team like Golden State, say, for example, will attack a lot of switches, is they really work hard on slipping. You know, flare screen. Say the ball goes into the post, and then they start their split action. Well, if there's a miscommunication for a half a second defensively on the switch, they're going to be able to slip or they're going to be able to flare screen from the weak side. So that's the second way that teams like Golden State will really try to attack switches, is by using slip screens and flare screens. And a lot of it comes off of a post entry too. So that's another thing that you see. And then the third way a lot of teams are going to attack switches is just by the continuous ball movement, until they can create a situation where they've got a mismatch on a closeout, or you're late on a recovery, and you'll be able to take advantage of that. Does that make sense at all? I mean, can you kind of visualize that in your head as I'm talking through it?
I can 100%. And that's the question. I mean, especially for, as you move down in levels, including the team I have this year, is I don't necessarily have a guy. Like last year, we had a guy that we could pull out and we could ISO a little bit off of a boomerang pass or just straight up pull back and go. But if you don't have that guy, the question is, should you even worry about the switch? Like, is that going to screw us up more than just, as you said, continuous ball movement and then figure it out? Because when you take yourself out of your offense.
I think that's a good point. Yeah. Well, and a lot of teams will switch it knowing that you're going to stop the ball. The ball's going to stop. You're going to try to go to the – and I think, to be honest with you, Golden State kind of got caught up in that a little bit too much last year against Houston. The ball stopped moving. They started going to, you know, the ISO at the nail or wherever it was. And it kind of took them out of their rhythm a little bit. I think they were much better when they just continued to move the ball and look for the slip screen and the flare screens and stuff like that.
No, that's a great point, Coach.
I don't want to be critical of Golden State because they're the best team, obviously. But, you know, you can see it happen a little bit. All of a sudden, it's like Houston's doing all this switching and the ball stops moving.
Well, I think everyone that was watching that series thought, this isn't the type of basketball that I'm in love with watching. Like, everyone's in love with the continuous ball movement, you know, the great teamwork, all that stuff. And I mean, I admire it because it's incredible discipline and thinking to be able to obviously attack matchups. And I understand the value of that, but I think they're, you know, coaches certainly would prefer what you were saying, is that Golden State would continue the ball movement and just figure it out because they're talented enough. But again, it's hard. It's such an enticement. Oh, we have a matchup. Let's go to the matchup. Do you think people are going to try and go to a post matchup more? Or is it still always going to be perimeter focused? I mean, it's easier to attack.
I think what you'll see, if people try to do the post matchup, you'll see more double switching. Mm-hmm. What I mean by that is, you know, we'll get the guard out of there as quick as you can by double switching the nearest big onto the guard as he rolls down to the post.
Of course.
Yeah, it takes practice and it takes tremendous communication and being able to talk. And Golden State is really good at post switching because they have Draymond back there directing traffic and telling guys where to go and being very vocal. And we're good with that with DJ. You know, if we wanted to double switch, you know, have DJ get back onto the big, we're pretty good at that. So you have to be a very good team communication-wise. And you got to be pretty sharp. You got to be on the ball. You got to be very aware to be able to double switch like that. But defensively, I'm a big proponent of switching. If you got the guys that can do it, one of the most valuable things, Chris, in our league right now is a big that can guard a switch. He can get out there and get in his stance and keep the ball in front of him, especially at the end of the shot clock. That's a huge thing for big guys in our league to be able to do. Those guys will have a lot of value.
Well, and again, I mean, these questions are going to unfold over the next season or two as we, you know, someone's going to figure out how to adapt and someone's going to figure out possibly a new way to counter it. And I know some NBA coaches I talked about possibly this might bring back defensive shocking on ball screens or showing and, you know, different types of things to avoid switching sometimes as well. So we'll be curious kind of how teams adapt, because what it comes back to is one of your points that you made. You don't always have the personnel. You don't always have the personnel to be able to do that. Or as you said, the experience, because there has to be a communication cue to it all too. So, and some teams simply don't have that guy or those players to be able to do that. So,
And one of the most important things to become, it's really, really hard to become a really good defensive team at our level. If you have a bunch of young guys, you can be pretty good offensively, but defensively it takes a while and some experience to really understand the concepts of the NBA, because it is different than college. You know, it's a different game. And so a very, very good defensive team is usually an experienced team. it's difficult to be a good defensive team with a bunch of young guys.
I've always suggested to high school coaches, maybe for a different reason, that switching on defense is incredibly valuable. One, there aren't obviously that big a variation in most personnel from your opponent or to you, but also it just saves you time. You have such limited time to coach your players, and offense is much harder to coach than defense. And that by switching, you save yourself time in terms of, you know, teaching every defensive screen, every defensive rotation, right, every scenario. It's just like, let's switch, keep the ball in front, figure it out. Now let's get really good. Not to say defense is invaluable. I mean, you got to be a top five defense and offense, right? I mean, to win a championship. That's basically what the NBA says, right? So do you have any thoughts on that? Is that something that you would suggest?
I do. I have really strong thoughts for the high school coach out there. Especially, imagine you're the high school coach and you're a small high school and half your team plays football. And you don't get those guys till, you know, maybe a couple weeks before your first game. And if it's a good football team, you don't get them until December 1st. And now you don't have a lot of time to practice. And you got to take those football players and you got to integrate them with your six or seven basketball guys that you've had since September. And I think switching in high school is terrific, especially if you got a bunch of guys that are about the same size and you're able to switch personnel wise. It makes sense. And you don't have a lot of time. I would be pressing and using those football players that have those kind of abilities to play free safety or cornerback and they can anticipate and steal the ball. I would put in whatever press you want to put in. One of the best high school coaches that I've ever seen is a really good friend of mine. He coaches in Texas. His name is Kenny Hoffbauer. And if any high school coach wants to know how to press and put in presses with very limited practice time because you got a bunch of football guys coming, he's the guy to contact. But I think pressing and switching, especially in a high school where you're getting those football guys late, I think that's really, really important. Does that make any sense at all?
Totally, coach. I mean, you make nothing but sense. And I guess, again, well, coach, I mean, just again, I'm so grateful. I mean, the experiences you share and the advice you share, and there's so many things that you've talked about that will stimulate thinking. And, you know, I think just generally to understand that you as a coach, myself as a coach, like, it's not like we haven't made a lot of those mistakes. We've all made those mistakes, and it's just providing some insights about how to potentially not make it again, or obviously if you're a younger coach and going into certain, some of these situations, to really consider some of these ideas to be able to help you succeed. And that's ultimately.
Yeah. And you know, the further I keep going in this crazy, crazy basketball stuff, I'm going to continue to make mistakes. We all make mistakes and we all are. Just hopefully you learn from them and don't keep making the same ones over and over, but mistakes are going to happen. That's just the nature of our business.
Tremendous stuff, coach. Really appreciate you taking the time. And I know, again, we'll have some future conversations.
Thank you.
No, and have a great season. And coach, we'll talk to you again.
Thank you so much.
To find out more about coach and all we spoke about today, please take a look at the show notes for today's episode. I love to share the game and have basketball coaching conversations. So connect with me on social media. You can find all my social media information and all your membership, clinic, and consulting needs at basketballimmersion.com. That concludes today's episode. I know there are so many podcasts out there. Thank you for taking the time to listen to the basketball podcast with me, your host, Chris Oliver. Please subscribe and share the podcast with your friends and colleagues so that we can keep bringing you the best of what's out there and share the game.